Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Joyce Carol Oates, who reads from and discusses her acclaimed novel, The Grave Digger's Daughter, published by HarperCollins. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore, because when you buy your books here, you enable us to continue to bring you programming like you're about to enjoy this evening. Joyce Carol Oates is a recipient of the National Book Award and the Penn Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. She has written some of the most enduring fiction of our time, including the national bestsellers We Were the Mulvaneys, Blonde, which was nominated for the National Book Award, and The Falls, which won the 2005 Prix Femina. She is the Roger S. Berland Distinguished Professor of the Humanities at Princeton, and since 1978 has been a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. In 2003, she received the Commonwealth Award for Distinguished Service in Literature, as well as the Kenyon Review Award for Literary Achievement. And in 2006, she received the Chicago Tribune Lifetime Achievement Award for Literature. We're honored that Joyce Carol Oates has returned to the Tattered Cover this evening to present her new novel, The Grave Digger's Daughter. Would you please join me in making her feel welcome?
Oh, thank you for the gracious introduction and such a warm welcome. This is my favorite bookstore. I could just wander in it. It has a kind of child, it seems to answer a kind of childlike wish that one could just wander and be secretive and be in a corner with a book and reading and dreaming, and then hours go by and nobody knows where you are. There's something about this store, just the opposite of a kind of utilitarian and Spartan look. Here you feel that there are recesses of memory, basically. You know, you turn a corner and there's something there out of the past. Well, I'm going to be reading from my new novel, The Gravedigger's Daughter. It was so hard for me to write this novel. I don't usually say things like this, but I felt very vulnerable and very strange about it. It's based on an events in my own family that took place long before I was born. I was trying to imagine the life of my own grandmother, who is a woman of quintessential warmth and spiritual beauty. She was it seemed like she was a born grandmother. And she exuded that air of magnanimity and generosity that just seems to change one's life. You know, if you're a little child, you internalize this love that's given you without any qualification. And many, many years later, when you are even maybe older than your grandmother was at the age that this first occurred, you can evoke that memory, and it's so warm, and it just makes you feel as if you had been loved and that there's some worth in you. Then I found out, after my grandmother died, some years, when a man named Greg Johnson was researching my biography, I found out many things about my grandmother that I had not known and that had been secrets. I think that many people did not know, though I guess my father must have known some of it. Anyway, it turns out that she was Jewish, and she was born of parents who came from Germany in the 1890s. In the novel, I moved it up to 1936 because I make this fictitious character a little closer to my own age and my own time. Wanted the novel to go up into a present time. They came over from Germany in the 1890s, and instead of settling in a city where they might have lived in a neighborhood with other Jews and had a community and shared their religion and background, they seem to have shunned that, and they moved to upstate New York, which is an area called the Snow Belt, which is north of Buffalo. Maybe you don't know anything about it, and you're not missing too much. It's a very hard area to live in, and lots of snow and harshness. I can't imagine why anyone would have chosen to live there. And my great-grandfather, whom, of course, I never knew, he was dead long, long before I was born, he became a gravedigger. And so my grandmother's The Gravedigger's Daughter is the name of the novel. And I wanted to pay homage to a certain kind of woman who lives for others, who is very warm and loving, and has secrets. And I felt, in retrospect, that my grandmother, like so many people with painful and tragic or traumatic pasts, really kind of an ugly past that one would not want to talk about, sort of remade herself. In the novel, she remakes herself as Hazel Jones. She changes everything about herself. She changes her hair. She changes her whole personality. She becomes very much like June Allison, sort of an American icon, and she leaves behind her this tragic and heavy-hearted history in order to sort of remake herself. So I will be reading from an excerpt from the novel, and then I'll be hoping that you might have some questions. We can have a little conversation. I really look forward to that. The Gravedigger's Daughter. November 1936. By bus, the Schwart family arrived in this small town in upstate New York. Out of nowhere, they seemed to have come with bulging suitcases, valises, bags. Their eyes were haggard in their faces. Their clothes were disheveled, their hair uncombed. Obviously, they were foreigners, immigrants. It would be said of the Schwarts that they looked like they'd been on the run from the Führer. In 1936, in such places as Millburn, New York, it was possible to think of Adolf Hitler with his mustache and military posture and stark, staring eyes as comical, not unlike Charlie Chaplin. The smell that came off him, the bus driver would so comment, rolling his eyes. It seemed appropriate that Jacob Schwart, the head of the family, would find work as caretaker of the Millburn Township Cemetery at the ragged edge of town. He and his family, wife, two sons, infant daughter, would live in the weathered stone cottage just inside the cemetery gates. This cottage, quote-unquote, was rent-free, which made the job attractive to a man desperate for a place to live. Mr. Schwart was profusely grateful to the township officials who hired him, though he had no experience as a cemetery caretaker, nor even as a gravedigger. Just parenthetically, I should mention that in Germany, he had been a math teacher at a very prestigious prep school, but until being Jewish, he was forced out by anti-Semitic laws. He was a good worker, he insisted, with his hands and with his head. You will not regret, sirs, I will assure you. At the time they'd moved into the cobwebby stone cottage in the cemetery that had been only casually cleared after the departure of the previous tenants, the Schwartz's youngest child, Rebecca, was a sickly 5-month-old infant tightly wrapped in her mother's filthy shawl. For much of the bus ride from downstate New York, the shawl had functioned as a sort of secondary diaper for the fretting infant. So little she was, her brother Herschel would afterward recall, she looked like some hairless thing, like a baby pig, and smelled like one, too. Herschel is a very hulking boy of about 19 or 20. He's Rebecca's older brother, and he is someone who was born in Germany, and he obviously had known how to speak German. Then he comes to this country under these terrible conditions that people were fleeing as refugees and coming in their ship down in the hold, and he just becomes almost like an animal. And then in this country, he's supposed to be learning English, but he never quite learns English, and then he starts to forget his German. So he doesn't really have much language at all. He's sort of a pre or non or meta literate person. And so I have made up a language for him. Pa wouldn't look at you hardly. He was thinking you would die, I guess. So Herschel has a certain primitive and cunning, like an animal cunning and instinct. He knows that their father really loves Rebecca very much, but the father doesn't want to look at the little girl too closely and doesn't want to say her name out of a primitive fear that she would die. Had she been Rebecca Schwartz then, she'd had no name and no identity so young. Of those early days and weeks, months, and family years in Milburn, she would recall so little, for there was little memory in the Schwartz family. There was Ma, who nursed her, and Ma, who sometimes pushed her away with a grunt, as if her touch were painful. There was Pa. Jacob Schwartz, he was. You could not predict Pa. Like the sky, Pa was always changing. Like the ugly coal-burning stove in the kitchen, Pa was smoldering sometimes, flaring up sometimes. You would not wish to press your fingers experimentally against the stove when the fire was up inside. Other times, the stove was empty of fire, cold and dead. Jacob Schwartz was profusely grateful to be hired by strangers in this small country town, yet Pa, brooding in the stone cottage, expressed a different sentiment. Like a dog they wish to treat me, huh? Jacob I am, huh? Because I am foreign, I am not rich, I am not one of them. One day they will see who is a dog and who is a man. Already as an infant, she would begin to acquire an instinctive sense that her father, this powerful presence that leaned over her crib, sometimes poked her with wondering fingers, and even lifted her in his arms, had been grievously wounded in his soul and would bear the disfigurement of this wound like a twisted spine throughout his life. She seemed to know, even as she shrank from such terrible knowledge, that she, the lastborn of the family, the little one, had not been wanted by Jacob Schwartz, and was an outward sign of his wound. She would not know why. A child does not ask why. She would remember her panicked mother stumbling to her crib, clamping a moist hand over her mouth to muffle her crying, that Pa not be awakened from his exhausted sleep in the next room. No, please, no. He will murder us both. The next little section is Jacob Schwartz thinking. He had been an intellectual. He went to university and studied philosophy. Among the philosophers he studied was Hegel, and he studied 19th century philosophy, which had a certain belief in progress. You know, 100 years ago, and little more than 100 years ago, people like us, many of people in this room, would have believed in the perfectibility of humankind. In the wake of Darwin, there was a strong belief, of course, not only biological evolution, that our species is ascending, and becoming ever more intellectual and capable of survival, but also that we were evolving morally. The human race was evolving morally. Then after the World War I, and then particularly after World War II, and the revelation of the genocidal agenda of the Nazis and anti-Semitism and barbarism in Europe generally, it was no longer possible for people to believe that we were evolving morally. And he's thinking, history has no existence. All that exists are individuals, and of those only individual moments, as broken off from one another, as shattered vertebrae. These words he hand-printed, gripping a pencil clumsily in his stiffening fingers. He had so many thoughts. In the cemetery, his head was invaded by thoughts he could not control. Clumsily, he wrote down these thoughts. He wondered if they were his. He stared at them, pondered them, crumpled the paper in his hand, and tossed it into the stove. The next little section is people in the town more or less looking at Jacob Schwartz. You saw him at a distance, the gravedigger Schwartz. Like a troll, he appeared, somewhat hunched and head lowered. In the cemetery amid the gravestones, grimacing to himself as he wielded a scythe, a sickle, a rake, as he pushed a rusted hand mower in fierce and unvarying swaths through the dense crabgrass, as he paused to wipe his forehead and to drink from a jar he carried in his coverall pocket, tipping back his head, eyes shut and gulping like a thirsty dog. Schoolboys sometimes squatted behind the cemetery wall that was about 3 feet high. At the front of the entrance of the cemetery, there was a wrought iron gate that could be dragged shut only with difficulty. Beyond this, several sheds and outbuildings. The oldest gravestones ran practically to the rear of the cottage, to the grassy area where the caretaker's wife hung laundry on clotheslines. If the schoolboys couldn't get close enough to Mr. Schwartz to taunt him or to toss chestnuts at him, They sometimes settle for Mrs. Schwartz, who would give a sharp little cry of alarm, pain, terror, drop what she was doing in the grass, and run panicked into the rear of the house in a way that was very funny. Some of the schoolboys who harassed Jacob Schwartz were as young as 10 or 11. In time, others would be older, and some weren't schoolboys any longer, but young men in their 20s. Their shouts, wayward and capricious and seemingly brainless, as the raucous cries of crows in the tall oaks at the rear of the cemetery. Gravedigger, Kraut, Nazi, Jew. Next little section is Jacob in the cemetery, and Rebecca is, little Rebecca is like 4 or 5 years old, wanting to play with him. Surrounded by crosses, he laughed. There was merriment in his laughter. He would joke, for God was a joker. You could not take God seriously. I rub my eyes. This is a dream. I'm trapped in a dream. Every morning the same dream. Jacob is a ghost wandering this place, tending the Christian dead. He talked to himself, for there was no one else. He could not talk to Anna, his wife. He could not talk to his children. He saw in their eyes how they condemned him. He saw in the eyes of those others how they pitied him. Those others in italics is the way Jacob thinks of the townspeople, the rural people who surround him, who are all Christians and look upon him with a kind of scorn. But there was a little one. She had not died of a bronchial infection this past winter. She was Rebecca. He was coming to speak that name now he'd so long resisted. Now that she was old enough to walk unassisted, even to follow her father out into the cemetery in their game of Nazi, she would hide behind the grave markers and he would not see her. She would giggle and squeal and peek out, and still he would not see her. His eye had squinted and pinched, for he'd lost his glasses somewhere. They'd been taken from him and snapped in two. The owl of Minerva soars only at dusk. This is an italicized remark. Owl is the bird, O-W-L. Minerva is the goddess of wisdom. That was Hegel, an old philosopher, admitting failure. Hegel means by this metaphorical statement that the wisdom that we acquire from our experience as we are older comes too late. We have our wisdom from our lives, but we can't pass it on to the younger generations. Younger generations have to make their own mistakes and have their own suffering. I was thinking when I was reading this, maybe when I was writing it too, I wrote this a few years ago. I put my novels away in a drawer for about 15 months, but the Iraqi war was already going on at that time. How much more true this is now that the owl of Minerva soars only at dusk, it seems. So belatedly a kind of wisdom comes from that kind of warfare and involvement in a distant part of the world. And at the time when we initiated it, it had seemed, to some people at least, not to have been an impossible task. It had maybe seemed to some people, in some quarters, a noble task. Who knows? But now it doesn't seem as if that is the case. The owl of Minerva soars only at dusk. Oh, Pa's eyes scraped over the little one without seeing her. He was not a large man, but he'd become strong in this job. He was a short, stocky man with the hands and feet of a woman, yet he wore the previous caretaker's boots, cleverly fitted up with rags. In the game of Nazi, the little one would slip from the house and follow him into the cemetery. This was so delicious. Hiding from him, she was invisible. Peeking out to see him, she was invisible. Ducking back behind a grave marker, quivering like a little animal, and his eyes scraping over her, as if she was no more than one of those tiny white butterflies. Nobody. There is nobody there. Is there a little ghosty I see? No, nobody. At this early hour, Pa would not be drinking. He would not be impatient with her. He would wink at her and make the smack-smack noise with his lips. His work trousers were tucked into his rubber boots, his flannel shirt loosely tucked into the beltless waist of his trousers. Shirt sleeves rolled up, the wiry hands on his forearms glinting like metal. His jaws moved. He smiled and grimaced as he swung the scythe, turning from her. Little ghosty, go back to the house, huh? Go now. The wonderful game of Nazi was over, was it? How could you tell when the game was over? For suddenly Pa would not see her, as if his eyes had gone blind. she wants to play, and her father is done with playing, and she can sort of frets and whines and follows after him. Her plaintive voice lifted thinly. Pa, he seemed not to hear her. He was absorbed in his work. He was lost to her now, her child heart contracted in hurt and in shame. But she continues to follow after him with the persistence of such a small child, and she is whining and sobbing a little. Ask him if she could help him with his work, and he doesn't want her to be there. And then she stumbles and falls down, and he's angry. He says, "Damn, I said." He was impatient with her, and he was not smiling, pushing the wheelbarrow through the dense grass with his back to her. This was not seeing now. This was death. Deeply wounded she was so many times, till at last she would tell herself that she hated him. Long before his death and the terrible circumstances of his death, she would come to hate him. Long she would have forgotten how once she'd adored him when she was a little girl and he had seemed to love her sometimes in the game of Nazi. The next little section is like the townspeople thinking and talking to Jacob, talking about them. Schwart, that's a Jew name, yeah? So do I mean Hebrew? No, says Jacob. No, it's a German name. He and his family were German Protestants. Their Christian faith was derived from a Protestant sect founded by a contemporary of Martin Luther in the 16th century. Next little section is Gus, Rebecca's older brother, coming home from school. The day Gus came running home from school, frightened and sniveling, asking Ma, "What's a Jew? What's a damn Jew?" Those kids on the post road were teasing him, and Hank Diggles threw corn cobs at him, and everybody was laughing like they hated him, and some of them he thought were his friends. And Ma was near to fainting, looking like a drowning woman, tied a scarf over her hair, and ran to find Pa in the cemetery, stammering and panting for breath. And it was the first time in memory he'd seen her, his wife, this far from the house, outside in the cemetery. He was shocked at how frightened she looked, how disheveled, and the shapeless house dress and, in fact, her stockings were rolled down to her ankles. Her face now was puffy and bloated, where once she'd been a slender, pretty girl, smiling shyly in adoration of her schoolteacher husband. And she'd played Chopin, Beethoven, Mendelssohn on the piano. God, he had loved her. And now this clumsy woman stammering broken English, so he had trouble figuring out what she was saying. He thought it might be those damn kids tossing corn cobs at the laundry on the line or at her. And then he heard Jew, Jew, he heard, and took hold of her shoulders and shook her, telling her to shut her mouth, get back inside the house. And that evening when he saw Gus, who was 10 years old at the time in fifth grade, Jacob Schwartz slapped the boy open-handed across the face, saying these words Gus would long recall, as would his sister Rebecca standing close by, "Never say it." And the last section is takes place on Halloween morning. I don't know if it's true in this part of the world, but where I come from, there's something called Devil's Night, and it's sort of a night of pranks and mischief, and sometimes becomes vandalism. Herschel says, "Pa, get the hell out here." There came Herschel careening and panting in the kitchen door. He was a tall, lumbering, horsey boy with unshaven jaws and a raw, braying voice. It was a cold autumn morning. It was the morning of Halloween, 1948. Rebecca was 12 years old and in seventh grade. It was shortly past dawn. The sky was gray in twilight, and in the east behind the Chautauqua Mountains, the sun was a faintly hooded, glowing hooded eye. Rebecca was helping Ma prepare breakfast. Pa and coveralls stood at the sink pumping water, coughing and noisily spitting in that way of his. Pa looked up at Herschel sharply, saying, "What? What is it? You best come outside by yourself, Pa." Herschel spoke with uncharacteristic grimness. She looked to see if he'd wink and screw up his eyes in that comical way of his, give some sign that he was joking, but he was serious. Jacob Schwartz stared at his elder son and saw something in the boy's face, fury, hurt, bafflement, and quivering animal excitement he had not seen before. He cursed and reached for the poker behind the stove. Herschel laughed harshly, saying, "Too late for any poker, Pa." Pa followed Herschel outside limping. Rebecca would have followed, but Pa turned as if an instinct to warn her, "Stay inside, girl." Anna Schwartz at the stove, looking at no one, removed the heavy iron frying pan from the burner and set it to the side. Bastards. Herschel led the way. Pa followed close beside him, swaying like a drunken man and staring. The night before Halloween was known as Devil's Night. In the Chautauqua Valley, it seemed to be an old, in some way revered, tradition. Pranks were committed by unknown parties who came in stealth in the dark. Mischief. You were meant to take it as a joke. Think I don't know who done this? Christ's sake, I do. I got a good idea, see? Herschel spoke in disgust, his voice trembling. Jacob Schwartz was barely listening to his son. The night before he tried to close the front entrance, he dragged the gates shut with a chain. He knew what Devil's Night was, had been damaged to the cemetery in the past. Tried to stay awake to protect the property, but he'd been exhausted and he'd been drinking. He fell asleep by midnight, and anyway, he had no weapon, no gun. Men and boys as young as 12 owned rifles and shotguns, but Jacob Schwartz had not yet armed himself. He had a horror of firearms. He was not a hunter. A part of him had long cautioned against that step. Arm yourself. One day it will be too late. A part of him wanted neither to kill nor to be killed. But in the end, his enemies were giving him no choice. Vandals had not been deterred by shut gates. You could see they knocked down part of the wall. Herschel seemed to know who they were or to suspect. Jacob Schwartz stumbled behind his son, wiping at his eyes. No keeping your enemies out if you are unarmed. He would not make that mistake again. Crockery and flower pots had been broken among the graves. Pumpkins had been smashed with a look of frenzied revelry, their spilled seeds and juicy flesh looking like spilled brains. Already, crows had been feasting on those spilled brains. Get away, sons of bitches! Herschel clapped his hand to scatter the crows. His father seemed scarcely to notice them. Crows. What did he care for crows? A number of the younger birch trees had been cruelly bent to the ground and were now broken back and would not recover. Several of the oldest and most frail of the gravestones, dating back to 1791, had been knocked over and were cracked. All four tires on the caretaker's pickup had been slashed so that the truck sagged on its wheel rims. And on the truck sides were marks in tar, ugly marks with the authority of jeering shouts. And on the caretaker's sheds and on the front door of the caretaker's stone cottage, so that the ugly marks were fully visible from the gravel drive and would be seen by all visitors to the cemetery. And these are these swastikas that they've put on in black tar because they're upstate New York, and they're not too bright. They haven't got the swastikas exactly correct. It's a little tricky to get that right, but the idea is there. The squiggles. Gus, too, had run outside, and Rebecca followed, hugging herself in the cold. She was too confused to be frightened at first. Yet how strange it was, her father was silent. So strangely silent. Pa, what's it mean? Pa ignored her. Rebecca put her hand out to touch the tar where it had been scrawled on the side of her shed. The tar was cold and hardened. She couldn't remember what the marks were called. Something ugly sounded, beginning with S. But she knew what they meant. Germany, Nazis, the Axis powers that had been defeated in the war. But the war had been over for a long time now, hadn't it? Rebecca calculated she'd been in fourth grade when the Milburn fire siren had gone off and all classes at the grammar school were canceled for the day. Now she was in seventh grade. 3 years, the Germans had surrendered to the Allies in May 1945. That seemed to her a very long time ago when she'd been a little girl. Herschel and Gus were talking excitedly, still Pa stood staring and wiping at his eyes. It was not like Jacob Schwartz to be so quiet. His children were aware of him, uneasy. He seemed confused, older than Rebecca had ever seen him. In the stark morning light, his face looked battered and misshapen. His eyes were ringed in fatigue. His mouth moved helplessly, as if he couldn't chew what had been thrust into it, couldn't swallow or spit it out. Herschel was saying again how he had a damn good idea who they were who'd done this, and Gus, aroused and indignant, was agreeing. Rebecca wiped at her eyes that were watery in the cold. The eastern sky was lightening now. There were breaks and fissures in the cloud overhead. She was seeing the ugly marks swastika, she remembered they were called, to her father's eyes. How could you remove them? Black tar that hardened worse than paint. How could you clean them off or scrub them off? And how upset Ma would be. Oh, if they could hide the marks from Ma somehow. But Rebecca's mother would know, of course. She already knew. Anna Schwartz's instinct was to fear and suspect the worst. By now she would be cowering behind the window, peering out. Not just the swastikas, but the birch trees that tore at your heart to see, and the broken flower pots and smashed pumpkins, the cracked gravestones that could not be replaced. Why do they hate us? Rebecca spoke softly, yet her father heard her. He turned toward her and came limping toward her. You, goddamn you, what I tell you, girl, get inside with your goddamn ma. Jacob Schwartz had become furious suddenly. He lunged at her, even with his bad knee. He moved swiftly, grabbing Rebecca by her upper arm and dragging her back to the house, cursing her, hurting her, so that Rebecca cried out, and both her brothers protested, Pa, hey, though keeping their distance and not daring to touch him. Inside, I said, and if you tell your goddamn ma about this, I will break your ass. His fingers would leave bruises in Rebecca's flesh. She would contemplate for days, like swastika marks these were, ugly, purplish-orange bruises. And the fury with which he'd muttered, ma, that short, blunt syllable in Jacob Schwartz's mouth, sounding like a curse, she thinks, he is the one who hates us, but why? Thank you. I can fast forward ahead a little and say that Herschel does get his revenge. He knows who has done this desecration. He gets his revenge in a typical way. He beats up these boys, and one of them he carves a swastika in his forehead. Well, that's upstate New York, and a long time ago, I'm sure they did things like that in Colorado, too. And now I live in Princeton, and people just sort of call their lawyers. They don't do this good old macho, old-fashioned kind of retaliation.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 11th, 2007.